speaker in the afternoon and being the moderator too. So we'll see. But thanks for hanging in there. I think there's some very interesting topics, but some are similar and some are quite different. And this one might be the quite different. I'm going to be talking, the whole session we're talking about is, on taxation and, other issues in health policy. And I'm going to be talking about something that might, for many, is very esoteric. And it sure was for me when I got involved with it, and I think to some extent still is. But here we go. Okay, I didn't get the disclaimer slide up there, but I don't have any conflict of interest or anything of that sort. I work for the American Medical Association. Maybe that's a disclaimer right there. And I've worked on alcohol policy for a number of years on the project that was referred to, the college alcohol study. I worked on that for 5 years as a deputy director of a matter of degree and got interested at that time in this issue of the global trade agreements. And you'll see why I got interested in it. You hear about global trade all the time, and allegedly there's a lot of benefits to liberalization of trade: more competition, efficiency, better quality, lower prices, a lot of foreign investment, and job growth. And if you have job growth and economic growth, you have better improved standards of living. And hopefully, with the social determinants of health, you improve health as one of the outcomes of that. Now, the trade agreements are negotiated in secret by governments, but very, very closely allied with the business community. And this is something from the tobacco movement with one of our soon-to-be-gone officials. And it's a lot easier to sell cigarettes around the world when you have the U.S. government on your team. But it's also not just tobacco, but alcohol as well. And because there's definitely a merger, a synergy, congruence between trade policy of governments and business interests. And not only business interests that are socially useful, but others that are socially questionable. There's a philosophy of free trade, although that might be questioned in the last few months, the unfettered regulations. Also, governments tend to promote the interests of their major industries and producers, and it's very obvious in tobacco, but also in alcohol as well. Now, in our government, in many places around the world, there's a revolving door between business and government, and we see this. I'll give you an example of one individual, Deborah Lamb, who used to work for the Senate Finance Committee. She worked there for 10 years, and she actually worked on the formulation of trade relations between the U.S. and China. Well, she left that for probably a more prosperous job as the vice president of trade and international issues for a coalition of hard liquor groups, the DISCUS. The DISCUS is the Distilled Spirits Council of the U.S. And she was named by President Bush to the U.S. Trade Representative's Transition Advisory Team, and she has been very, very active representing her interest group in Washington. Now, at this point, our U.S. trade is handled by the executive branch of government, and the U.S. Trade Representative has 14 advisory committees of groups that advise the government on policy. And of those 14 committees, three of them have relations or have that would cover alcohol, but also tobacco and some other things. And of three of the 14, have very significant alcohol interests involved. The consumer goods, which used to be chaired by Altria, consumer good was, that's a good consumer product. But right now, Discus and Brown and Foreman, the committee that deals with distribution of products around the world has representation. The one dealing with intellectual property has Anheuser-Busch and Discus. But there's no representation of public health interest. And the U.S. government itself, the Government Accountability Office, has noted that there is no public input, and particularly no public health input, in these trade agreements, and that should be addressed. Now, you've heard of the WTO, probably. Almost everybody has, the World Trade Organization. It's the only international organization dealing with the rules of trade between nations. And right now, there are 153 members, countries. And it was formed, I mean, there had been many, many trade agreements over the years, but it was most recently formalized in 1995 with the Uruguay Round, which formed the World Trade Organization. And it had significant influence of non-governmental organizations, of business and civil society. And at one of the recent ministerial meetings of the WTO, 65% of the civic organizations, the non-governmental organizations, were business interests. And some of these, there's a whole bunch of trade agreements at the international level. And some of them you've heard of, and probably most you haven't, and I'll put you to sleep real quick. Some of these deal with trade in tariffs. Now, originally, the trade agreements generally tried to get rid of tariffs, remove tariffs between countries on coal, on steel, on cotton, on whatever. And that was the bulk of the trade negotiations. And that was the case, and is an important part of it. But there are also trade agreements under the World Trade Organization that deal with barriers to trade, that deal with intellectual property. That's the TRIPS agreement. And one that's very, very significant for our field is the one dealing with trade in services. And when countries negotiate these treaties, when they join the WTO, they really have teeth. They really do. Because WTO establishes rules on tariffs and non-tariff issues, and they deal with obligations of governments, not only at the national level, but down at the local and state level, your policies can be affected. And when there's enforcement of these, they really have teeth, and the enforcement is done by different trade panels who are not public health people. They are trade lawyers, and they only think in the terms of trade. And when they meet in secret, there's no amicus, they're binding decisions. I'll give you some examples during our talk. Now, the GATS, the Global Agreement on Trade and Services, was the first and only set of multinational rules governing international trade in services. And I'll show you, we don't have a lot of time, but services are anything that you can't get your hand on. Any relationship or whatever that might deal with research and development on natural sciences, production, marketing, distribution, sales and products. And here's specifically in alcohol, the trade agreement might affect the production of alcohol, the transportation of alcohol, like the transportation of the grain to the brewery or the distillery. That would be covered under GATS. The alcohol production, the bottling, the distribution, marketing, advertising, even the serving of alcohol would be affected by GATS. So you can only imagine all the things and regulations that we might have nationally and locally that could be affected by GATS. And one of the former director generals said about GATS. He said GATS provides guarantees into areas never before recognized as trade policy. And he predicted, I suspect that neither governments nor industries have yet appreciated the full scope of these guarantees or the full value of existing commitments. And commitments are, when you make a commitment, you're opening up part of your economy to foreign markets. Foreign groups can come in and deal with a certain area of your service sector. Those are the commitments. And he's saying, we haven't even imagined all the implications. Well, I think the industries are starting to appreciate that. Now, the powerful countries dictate the terms of these trade agreements. And the World Bank even recognized this. They recognized that these trade agreements are one-sided power plays by the current WTO members, which can wring commercial advantage out of weaker economic partners. And some of these concessions to get into the WTO or to open up trade by these big countries like the United States or the European Union have often relate to alcohol. I'll give you two examples. Algeria, predominantly Muslim country, and alcohol is not particularly popular in the Muslim faith. They had to get into the WTO, to become one of those 153 nations, they had to lift their ban on alcohol imports in order to get into the WTO. And in Vietnam had a real rough time getting into the WTO. And the U.S. was really tough on them and to get in the WTO. And one of the things they needed to do, they had to change their tax policies, which favored U.S. domestic hard liquor. Now, right now, they're not only the international, the global treaties, but there are other regional ones and bilateral ones. And NAFTA, you hear about all the time in the presidential campaign, that was between the U.S. and its neighbors to the north and south, Canada and the United States. That's one of the regional ones. And there are bilateral, or the another regional one is CAFTA, between the Central America nations and Dominican Republic. And there are other ones that are just between a couple nations, like pending right now is U.S. and Colombia, and U.S. and Korea. And these regional bilateral agreements are easier to implement because just a couple countries get together. They don't have to worry about the whole global thing. And they have independent obligations and enforcement. And they really have clout. They have terms that are as strong, but stronger than the WTO. And the U.S. particularly has strong terms in these treaties. Now, they really have implications. In fact, the World Trade Organization, as free market as it is, they don't like the regional and bilateral agreements because they say it's really muddying the waters. It's making it difficult. And they've actually set up committees to look at the bad implications of having all these little ones. But the U.S. wants these little agreements between another nation, and the European Union wants them with another nation because they get real strong terms, stronger than the WTO. And if they get enough of these around the world, it sets a new norm for trade agreements. In the end, there can be very, very stringent. Okay, let me give you some examples now. The World Spirits Alliance is a group of international hard liquor groups. And they have, long ago, it was 1993 at the Cancun Conference, they said the things that they want in the trade agreements are to deal with tariffs, reduce the tariffs on distilled products so they can get their products in the countries. But then the non-tariff things, too, like import quotas and licensing restrictions and state trading. For example, a lot of countries, like Canada to some extent, Scandinavia, some of the United States, have state trading where the state actually controls the distribution of alcohol, like Oregon or Pennsylvania or Iowa, where you actually have a state store to sell certain kinds of alcohol. Well, they have that tremendously in the Scandinavia. And it really works to limit the distribution and control of the product, and you can control a lot of the problems. But the industry wants to undercut those state trading. The World Spirit Alliance said they also want to deal with liberalization of restrictions on marketing. Well, of course, free market, they want to do everything to maximize their advertising and get their product out there. And they want any restrictions removed on firms engaged in importation, distribution, or retailing. And something that may be very legitimate on the intellectual property, they want to protect their name. Like Budweiser once doesn't want to have to give up its name to a Czech company that has a similar name, even though there might be good reason for it. Or Kentucky Bourbon wants to be protected, and Champagne wants to be protected. So you can see some of these that are, you know, probably legitimate. They want to protect their name. So that's a big part of it as well. A little more recently in Hong Kong, the World Spirits Alliance said they want to eliminate non-tariff barriers But if they can't, they use even stronger measures under the WTO on technical barriers to trade, another treaty. Now, let me mention a couple ways that these companies are actually using the trade agreements and using political intimidation to open up markets. For example, Chile had tariffs to protect the local production of pisco, which is their local hard liquor, and it kept out the real posh, expensive foreign products. Well, the European Union and the U.S. said, well, you've got to get rid of this. Even though pisco didn't have the high alcohol content or whatever, they wanted to get in with their products. So they literally intimidated Chile, said, Chile, if you want to become a member of the WTO, you've got to change your tax laws. And so they intimidated this country, and really in very serious terms. Another example, the U.S. had something to protect or help developing countries. Poor countries have a duty-free importation. So countries could import into the United States duty-free to help that poor country. Well, that's not so good if that poor country didn't let our products get in there. So Romania wanted to have poor Romania. I've done some work there. It's a really poor country in Europe. And they were able to import products into the U.S. duty-free. But the U.S. Was pressured by the spirit industry in this country saying, we're not going to let this poor European country do that unless we can get our products into their markets. They use this political intimidation. Now, there's an inherent and growing tension between trade treaties and health-promoting alcohol policies. And the WHO had a book that they commissioned. In fact, the author, the editor was here, Tom Babor, and it's going to be updated. It's called Alcohol No Ordinary Commodity. And it's I highly recommend it. It's being rewritten. It'll come out with a new edition, I think, probably next year. And it's a very interesting term, no ordinary commodity. Alcohol, the alcohol industry wants to call this product just a beverage, even a healthy beverage, a health-promoting beverage. Well, we know it to be a drug and with significant implications. And in the trade agreements, it's considered just any commodity, like cotton, like sugar, like whatever. So, you know, there shouldn't be any discrimination because the more the merrier in free trade. Well, countries can actually limit certain things and say certain things are sensitive. We don't want to treat them like any commodity like cotton or sugar or anything else. And then there are more controls on some sensitive products. Well, the European Union doesn't want alcohol or tobacco to be sensitive. They want it just to be free flow. They only want to have things with restrictions, things like arms, weapons, ammunition, explosives, and a few things like that, because they want to get their products exposed as much as possible. And so they want to make sure these are exploited and expanded in the trade agreements. Now, if you have trade liberalization, if we're going to open up markets to everything and anything, we're going to see more competition for market share by international, multinational corporations who have more resources for aggressive advertising. They're going to bring in lower products or lower prices often, and with their aspirational goods, the things that are sexy, the international American product or the European product with easier-to-smoke products or Alka-Pops for girls or things of this sort, and this will happen. And problem is, these trade agreements have a real chilling effect on government policy, because in the trade agreements, if you do something that is considered a barrier to another country or another company's trade, they can actually sue you. So a government might not want to pass good alcohol policy because they're going to get sued by somebody in another country. And so it's a chilling effect on good policy. And some of the things that are threatened by these trade agreements are concerning things that relate to the distribution of alcohol. For example, things that deal with licensing. would be licensing of hours of service of bars might be under threat by these trade agreements. The number of alcohol outlets, and we've seen the more bars you have, the more problems you have. The certain types of alcohol products like Alcopops, we want to control that marketing of alcohol to kids. That might be threatened by these trade agreements. Keg registration might be affected by this. And in government monopolies, where it helps to be able to control and not have the private market exploit and get all their massive distribution. So we might have things like the existing or expansion or development of new monopolies around the world in alcohol that are good alcohol control policies threatened. What more is at stake? The information, education, prevention, and other things dealing with alcohol advertising and sponsorship may be threatened by these trade agreements. You recognize this? Katrina. What we have here with the development of international trade, more prosperity around the world, with a growing youth population around the world, with fewer restrictions and fewer public health measures, and the trade agreements which foster this, we're creating a perfect storm for alcohol problems around the world. So we suggest that we do things to control this, that we treat alcohol differently, encourage the World Health Organization to address trade more in its reports and in its work, involve health ministries and non-governmental organizations in trade agreements, and to get public health representation on these treaties so that it's not only profits but health is one of the goals of our trade with other countries. So obviously we need to raise awareness among non-governmental organizations like yours, treat alcohol as a special kind of product so we just don't maximize its trade and around the world. And I think, actually, if you've heard of the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, I think we should start to consider a global treaty dealing with alcohol control. So I'm Don Ziegler. I work at the American Medical Association. My contact information. And thank you for staying with us. I'll take some questions about this, but then also questions for our other panelists. And some of this will be coming out, the material here, in a paper in Addiction, which is one of the most prominent international publications on addiction, published in the UK, and in early next spring on the alcohol industry. Yes. Good question. I'm not sure. I don't know. Somebody know that? Norm, do you know that? Anybody? No? Tobin, do you know? Don't know. If whatever you know, let me know and we'll try to find out. Okay. Other questions? Questions of our panel? How are we doing time-wise? Yes, sir.
In the tobacco field, someone else mentioned shoes. But I will just say, in alcohol, at least in California, we do think of two different concepts, one being a tax and the other being a fee. And it has partly to do with the law in California is such that raising taxes requires a two-thirds vote in the legislature, which is a big pain in the neck. So the workaround is to try to assess a fee, which only requires a majority vote, and The trick there is you have to have a nexus between what you're raising the money for and what you're going to use the money for. So there have been attempts, this is by way of saying, have been attempts to say there should be maybe a user fee or some way to assess money, whether it's on industry or the drinker, which of course always gets passed to pay for cleaning up the mess, or even to pay for prevention and treatment programs, you know, however you want to frame it. So this idea of, you know, saying we want to earmark the money specifically for dealing with the costs has definitely been out there, and there have been attempts, you know, since the failure of the tax initiative in California in 1991, there was a slight increase passed the legislature. There have been maybe half a dozen attempts to get additional taxes raised, mostly through this fee mechanism, which, you know, theoretically is easier, but even that hasn't gotten through. I will say, while the public is more likely to support a fee approach, in other words, earmarking funds for programs, the politicians don't like it when you tell them what to do with the money. So there's sort of this trade-off, right? The politicians like just money to go in the general fund, and frankly, I think we're in a situation right now where politically more feasible to just say, you know, use the money to, you know, plug your hole in the budget and hopefully save some teachers. But, you know, so there's strategy that goes into whether you just, which approach you take, and of course it's going to vary state by state. But I wondered, I mean, you were asking about tobacco and I answered about the topic I knew. So do you know the answer to that? Oh, he was asking whether there, maybe you should. I will say that was attempted in the 1991 California initiative to say, to make exactly the argument you raised. But the other issue is that only a small number of people, you know, drink most of the alcohol, which is by way of saying they should be the ones paying. But it doesn't really pan out that way because, you know, the alcohol industry is very clever when you raise taxes at figuring out how to keep the dirt cheap products cheap. And, I mean, it's just, it doesn't always pan out the way you sort of want to paint the picture when it comes to it, but someone in the back who knows more about this than me wants to say something. Yes? I mean, I think we're up against, you know, just unbelievably powerful industry that is very effective at controlling the debate. And they, you know, they spent $30 million back in 1991 to defeat the California initiative. And they've been right in there. I mean, it's no accident that taxes haven't kept up with inflation. I mean, it's simply a matter of the alcohol industry's power. I will say one glimmer of hope is I just spoke last week at the National Beer Wholesalers Association, and while, you know, I won't make any promises, you know, I told them they had to stop lobbying against taxes, and there seems to be a bit of a rift going on between the wholesalers right now and the brewers, because the brewers are consolidating, so we have Miller Coors joining forces in the U.S., and we have this pending deal with InBev, this massive global conglomerate, which makes me even more scared about what you're talking about, poised to take over Anheuser-Busch, and that is causing the wholesalers, some of them are going to go out of business because of the consolidation, and there's also threats to the state regulatory system, which ensures that wholesaler middle tier, which is a really important factor in public health. So this is by way of saying that the wholesalers are starting to break rank a little bit from the beer makers, who really do their, who are the ones who are most threatened by increased taxes, and it's really the brewers who insist on the wholesalers lobbying in Congress and in every state legislature against taxes. And I'm, again, not making any promises, but I just said, if you guys really want to get our attention, then stop lobbying against taxes. I feel like there may be some shifting in ground, and that's why I'm bringing it up, because, you know, clearly, anytime we can divide and conquer this industry, that's a benefit.
The brewers want to even lower the taxes further.
Right, they have their rollback, they have that ridiculous campaign, roll back the taxes as if they're too high now. I mean, it's just insane, and it's a very effective strategy in Congress, because if you get, you know, however many representatives to sign on to this idea of rolling back the taxes, obviously you're not going to be even talking about raising it. But, you know, CSPI has been the real leader on this topic, and we've been talking to them about sort of taking the issue forward once more, trying to give it another shot. Both at the federal level and in states that are willing to take it on. And, you know, my impression is people are burned out on trying to raise taxes, but I also want to say I think there are other potential strategies for raising prices, like minimum pricing, ensuring that regulations, like Washington State has a regulation to not allow volume discounts, which was challenged by Costco. So big box retailers don't like it when states say you can't have volume discounts. Well, it's important that we make sure that states maintain those kinds of regulations, because that is another way to keep prices higher than they otherwise would be. So I think it's really important that public health people understand the economics and the policies, and to see when they're being threatened, and they are. The state regulatory system is under attack by the big box retailers and the wine industry, by the way, who want be able to ship their products across state lines, and again, that's interfering with the three-tier system. So, I'm sorry, I'm going on, but
yes. I'm more optimistic with Obama on that issue. There's much more public health focus, and probably the framework in that sense, tobacco control, will be ratified by that administration. If it's Republicans, it's not going to happen. That's my speculation.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to clarify. So, you know, we're definitely in a difficult situation if McCain gets in, because his wife, Cindy McCain, is the president of the third largest Anheuser-Busch distributor in the country, which is based in Arizona. And, I mean, it's no secret that his rise to political prominence was thanks to her money. And as someone said, you can't run a beer distributorship out of the White House. So hopefully that won't happen. But I think your question is well taken. You know, what can we do with whoever gets in? And if it is a Democratic administration, we do have to recognize the fact that, I mean, the alcohol industry and the beer distributors, I will say, used to give almost all their money to Republicans. Now they split it. You know, the industry figured out they got to play both sides. And so there's no question that there's going to be influence no matter who's in there. But we certainly have a better shot at holding a Democratic administration's feet to the fire and saying, okay, you know, here's what we need. Here's the mess that we need to clean up. And, you know, it's going to take us as advocates to be working at every level of government. I mean, I can't emphasize that enough, federal, state, and local. Our emphasis at my institute has been more at the state and local level in the past. We really want to work more with other states and at the federal level. So, you know, come talk to us and we can help figure out a strategy. And CSPI is also, of course, a great player in D.C. to work with.
Questions for our other speakers? Comments? Whoops. Well, thank you very much. You've hung in there. And I urge all of you to become associated with the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Other Drugs section. If you're a member of another section, you can do a little click-off on your membership and join us. And I hope you can all come in a half hour to our award ceremony and business meeting in right down the hall in Salon G. Thank you very much. You've been a very good and patient audience. And thanks very much for our speakers. Thank you. Yes. Well, on the straight side?
Yeah.
might find it interesting.
Yeah, I know them.
Yeah, we have business.
Finish.
Okay, yeah.
and then a number were selected to be a special supplement to addiction. And so you had jerky, and I mean top people. It's a blessing to be in.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I want to use that as paper in my class next year.
All right. Super. I've got one now already in DAR, the Australian Journal, Drug and Alcohol Review.
Okay.
It's harder to find that. But I've got one article on this topic, not about the industry, but just, it's on alcohol and tobacco in the trade rates. But this one is more specifically, what's the industry doing? It's hard to get it. We don't have the documents like the tobacco people.
Right.
You just scrounge around for a little piece here, we get a little internet stuff here. We'd love to have them meet the secret documents. This isn't even my job now anymore. I work in long range planning for the EMA, but I still got this bug in my body. She did a good job.
Yes,
very, very good, very important work.
Yeah, we've been thinking about this stuff for a while. Given that she's here and ready to go on this topic.
Excellent. And that's funded by the Robert Wood Johnson?
We're
internally.
Just doing it.
Okay.
It's called my independent study from last semester.
What's
that? It's my independent study from last semester for 2 credits.
International journal on substance abuse. It's called Addiction. It's out of out of England.
Okay.
And we're going to have a special supplement early in 2009. If you want the international perspective, that's where we are.
Okay.
Some of the top people working with WHO, international people at Robin Room and REM, and people from Canada, mm-hmm. and Norm's in there. But some people in this conference have written for it. So that would be a good question.
Do you think there's would be interest with other countries to work with people like me who have alcohol policy background?
May well. You might want to contact Tom. The GAFA. There's to look for GAFA. It's a global.
I know there's the Big Kettle Brewing Society, too.
Yeah, but they're... Yeah, God bless them.
I used to work with Fried Whitman, too.
Yeah, Fried, but
he was into that.
I know. Yeah, I spoke at their conference was in Riverside, California. Okay. Now they're all over the world.
Yeah.
And they're mostly researchers. They're not mostly the policy people.
Yeah.
But GAFA is a global... Alliance or something like that. Mm-hmm. They're based in online journal. It's more advocacy, more policy stuff called Globe. GAFA. They're based in the UK.
Okay.
They're good. They're not the researchers. They're the advocacy people.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, you see.
Now you're so famous.
Yeah.
And no one need to do this work. That's great.
Well,
I used to work for Institute for Focus Strategies. They had the AMOD program. They were the whole
Institute system. I worked on the AMOD project for 5 years.
Do you know James Baker?
I don't know James
Baker. Yeah, he's my boss.
He's great.
Yeah,
it's fine. And Dennis Alexander, do you know Dennis?
I think I met him.
There was a couple others. Most of that. Baker's work was done earlier in England. I came out in 2002. Most of that was done before that, and then overlapped a little bit. And then that was ended, the relationship with Baker. And not quite enough, but we kept on with it a little bit. And then Dennis Alexander Moore, who worked independently, he was an independent contractor. And he worked on the project in Florida, Georgia Tech, So you're okay. Annette Padilla, okay. You're in San Diego. Probably Barb Ryan. Okay. Yeah.
And
Don Cole, yeah, I know them well.
Yeah.
I saw Barb's here. She was here. They work closely with them. They wrote up the final report.
Yeah. I used to work with them on an OTS grant.
Yeah.
I was on a college campus.
Yeah.
And Barbara actually worked for someone got me involved.
Were you at AP Alcohol Policy 14 conference?
That was in there.
I'd already transitioned to my new job as a grant writer, so I wasn't there. It was Alcohol Policy 14, 2002 in Boston.
I think I was there.
They had one of those late night things.
It was 2002 or 2003?
Yeah, 2002 in Boston. And it was one of those late night things where they had a late break thing. Discussion of free readings. And it was the first time I heard of it. And I heard that and I said, this is major.
I think it is
major. So I went back to the AMA and started talking about it. And they said, what? Oh, we've never heard of this. Oh, no, it's not a problem. Our government would never allow that. I mean, that was the attitude. And I just wouldn't let go. So and all of a sudden, it's cool. What's your background? You have an MPH.
I have a master's in public health from San Diego State. Mm-hmm. And I can send you my resume if you're interested. I've worked for a lot of people in the field. So I go back to the 90s.
So you've gotten involved before,
I think. Mostly policy, advocacy, legislation, my background. And now I do training technical assistance, mostly with counties and the coalitions. But I'm not really allowed to do being coalitions to like bills that are pending, maybe, or alcohols, or things like that. So I don't,
There's some interesting things. The organization of state legislators, it's a national organization, like the Governors Association, the state legislators, they're really concerned about these trade agreements. Not just on alcohol, but on licensure, on importation of drugs. I mean, to get cheaper drugs for the Medicaid patients. All these are cut for this trade agreement. They're very concerned. And there's a book, you know, the control states, alcohol. Jim Sequeira, that group is very concerned because under these trade agreements, you can totally eliminate the control state. Totally. And in Canada, and being undercut in Scandinavia. And they have the club. They're on the committees. They got the air government. But here's the trade issues. There's a very good group in San Francisco called CPAP, Center for Policy Analysis on Trade and Value. CPAP, just CPAP.org.
Okay.
And
they're in San
Francisco. Ellen Schaefer, she's here. And no, it's not devoted to alcohol by any means. But Ellen Schaefer is on their website, a very good overview of trade agreements and how they affect public health in general.
Okay.
And the campaigns to get, even sue the government, to get public health people on those advisory committees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very fascinating.
Yeah.
That's cool.
That's great. Do you think you could send me your presentation?
Sure.
That might help me with my research.
It's real sketchy. It was only 15 minutes. I got a bunch of notes on my note page stuff. And it wasn't as formal a presentation as these other guys. You never know where people are at.
I thought it was very advanced for this group, and that's why there were no questions.
Well,
it's good. You need to kind of set the bar high and bring people up.
It's amazing how many people
come. I think people are very interested, and especially the work in emergency is very advanced, too, and the work on alcohol is very advanced. But it's good to set the bar high. You need to remind it.
Marty, it's very complex, so all the costs of some of these things. But it's very significant to me to get primary care docs to counsel patients on these lifestyle issues.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank
you. Are you going to go to the reception?
I don't think so. I'm just so tired. Maybe I'll just pop by. Maybe start one.
Yeah, I ran out of
time.
Okay. I ran out. You want me to write down?
No, I remember. I had many more programs.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And where's the reception?
In G.
Hi. Are you all set? Can I close things out?
You can close that up. Right.
Thank you.
This is mine. This is somebody else's. They can go away. That's some previous one. Yeah. Just go in the garbage here.